For most people, a journey up Mount Everest is a grueling once-in-a-lifetime adventure. But for Nawang Gambu, it was more than that. He summited the world's highest peak twice and was the first to accomplish that feat. I'm Maria Carter, and on today's Central Standard, we talk with longtime Kansas City reporter Bev Chapman about her new documentary detailing Gambu's journey from escaping childhood poverty to climbing to the top of Everest to eventually meeting President Kennedy. Later, we'll take a look at the private life and political times of Karl Marx, the influential political philosopher's thinking was shaped by everything from his father's conversion to Protestantism to his devoted wife to a life in exile. That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning. This is Central Standard. I'm Maria Carter. Later this hour, we'll be discussing Karl Marx and what made him who he was. But now we're turning toward a person who's been described as so famous, no one knows who he is. Nawang Gambu was a Nepalese Sherpa, and the first person ever to make it to the top of Mount Everest twice. That's a record he held for nearly two decades. Bev Chapman, a familiar name to many Kansas City TV viewers, has recently completed a documentary on Gambu and his journey. She'll be debuting Nawang Gambu, Heart of a Tiger, this Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Library. Joining us today is Bev Chapman. Bev, good morning.
Good morning, Maria. Thanks for having me.
Well, how did a reporter from KMBC go to doing a documentary on a Sherpa?
A flatlander making it, yeah. It's hard to imagine. It was really just kind of serendipity being at the right place at the right time. Several years ago, I was on a trek in Bhutan, and I was traveling with a friend of mine who's a photojournalist whom I'd worked with at a television station years ago. And Gambu was on this trek, and she said, "This guy is really famous, and nobody's ever heard of him." And so I laughed and I looked at her and I said, okay. And we ended up doing what turned out to be the last video interview of his life. And over the years, Maylee was in contact. Her name is Maylee Mason, my co-producer, was in contact with his family and said, you know, if you ever want us to do something with this, we'd be happy to create a short video for you. And he passed away in 2011. And shortly after that, they contacted Maylee and said, if you guys are still interested, we would love to have you do this.
Well, how did you get to where you met Gambu? What brought you there?
I actually really wanted to go to Nepal. And as a young woman, I always had this dream of making it to the base camp of Everest. Maylee had been to Nepal and talked me out of it. And she said, you know, let's go to Bhutan because it's more exotic and they're not letting many people over there and it's not very touristy. And so I reluctantly said, okay, you know, all right, Bhutan.
And it's the happiest country, right?
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, yeah. They do claim to have the per capita happiness gauge in their official economic reports. But yeah, it was beautiful.
Well, this is the 50th anniversary of the American ascent of Everest. What was Gambu's role in that expedition?
Gambu stood with the first American to summit Mount Everest, Jim Whittaker of Seattle. Gambu and he climbed together. They walked hand in hand to the top so that they couldn't say, you know, he made it first, etc. He was selected to be part of that expedition, and it really changed the course of his life when he was able to summit with an American.
And you mentioned, you know, why aren't more people familiar with who this guy is?
Well, number one, because he's not an American. He is rather famous in India. And in climbing circles, he's certainly well known. And he's become better known this year because of the 50th anniversary. He's the nephew of Tenzing Norgay, who was the first man to summit Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary in 1953. And in fact, Gambu was hired to be a porter on that expedition. He was only 17 and he was the youngest porter on the trek and made it to 26,000 feet twice during the 1953 expedition.
So, he had a long history with Everest.
He did. And it really was his dream. You know, he had this famous uncle. He grew up on the north side of Everest in Tibet. And as a child, looked at that mountain. And no doubt people, you know, always had their dreams about it. Although, interestingly enough, in the Sherpa culture in general at that time, people thought that it was crazy to want to climb Everest. They believed that there were spirits in the mountain and that if you, you know, were rude to them or if you violated the sanctity of the space, the bad things could happen to you.
Was it, you know, Westerners coming there and wanting to climb the mountain that really changed that culture, or what was that?
Well, I think if you talk to people who are intimate with the Sherpa culture, they'll tell you that there were certain Sherpas who really wanted to climb. But for the majority of them, it was a way to make a living. They were farmers or they were load carriers and they made very little money. And they could get paid to carry gear and scientific equipment and in some cases make as much in 3 months as they might in 3 years. So it really was a revenue source for most of them.
That's a big change in lifestyle, it sounds like.
Yes.
We were touching a little bit on Gombau's life before Everest. And we have a clip about his time kind of in the monastery and how he got out of it. So let's play that. And this is from your documentary.
Right.
And he had this very poignant story that he used to tell where the monks, the older monks, used to mercilessly beat him during the day. But at night, while he was sleeping, they would come and touch his feet for forgiveness.
And at some point, Gombau and one of his monks in training friends decided that it was time to escape from Rongbuk.
It was through the local loo, the toilet, where he really managed to, through the hole, he jumped and ran away. And
I just said, "You what?"
Well, who are some of those people that we were just hearing?
The first person you heard is Finjo Gombau, Gombau's son. The second one is a mountain climber named Phil Urschler. And the third is Gombau's brother-in-law, or son-in-law, rather, named Mo Tup. And the last person is Jim Wickwire, who was the first man to summit K2.
And so just in case if people missed it, he basically escaped through the toilet system.
That's
or
right.
The sewers.
That's
there.
Right. You know, Gombau was at the Rongbuk Monastery twice in his life. The first one's kind of humorous. When he was 3 years old, he was one of those children who was slow to talk. And his mom took him to the monastery and explained the problem to the monks and left him there for 3 days. And when she came back, they said, "There's nothing wrong with your son. He was just born with an unlucky name." So they renamed him. He was born Findlay Pasong, and they renamed him Nawang Gombau. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, he began to talk, which he probably would have anyway, obviously. And then when he was 11, it was the custom to send one member of the family to a monastery, and there were huge benefits in that they would become educated, and because there were regional children from all over coming there, you learn different dialects of the language. But Gombau found it very, very hard, and he was one of those kids who probably may have had some sort of a learning disability at first, but if you made a mistake, the punishment was commensurate to the mistake, and so he was constantly getting beaten. So he was there for a year and decided that he was going to escape, and the rest of that story about climbing through the hole is these boys are 11 years old. For the most part, all they have are their garments that they wore in the monastery, thin robes, and they went through a pass that's close to 18,000 feet in order to get to Nepal and get out of there. And it was a remarkable accomplishment for anybody, but for little boys at that age, it was really something for them to be able to survive that.
You think the first part of that story is bad. It's probably gets only worse from there.
Yeah, but it really was an escape of cinematic proportions. There were people who were hiding them when they got in the mountains, and they would sleep during the day and then try to get across the border at night. They didn't have adequate clothing. They wrapped plastic bags around their feet. They used actually a Tibetan flag because you can get snow blindness, so they would cover their eyes during the day with a flag so that they didn't get too close to the sun. And yeah, it was quite an accomplishment.
Well, if there were such punishments for small things, I can only imagine the punishment for running away.
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Maria Carter. Our guest is Bev Chapman. And today we're discussing her new documentary on Nawang Gombau, which debuts this Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Plaza Library. Kansas City, what would you like to know about the life of Gombau? Call 816-235-2000. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Well, he's 11 years old. What does he do after he's out of the monastery?
Well, he returns to Nepal. His family had resettled in the Khumbu Valley over there and basically begged forgiveness of his parents. Both of his parents had spent time in the monastery. His father had studied to be a monk, and his mother had studied to be a nun. And so he came home and said, "I'm really sorry," and they forgave him. And then as time went by, he got more and more interested. He knew his uncle was going to climb Everest with the British. That became a goal. And he saw that as his way out of what probably would have been his life role as either a farmer or somebody who was a merchant and was living a very meager life. And I know that he was attracted to the adventure of it. It was a very dashing thing to do back then, to be brave enough to want to take on a mountain.
Was he just one of those kids that school wasn't for him? He wanted to be out there kind of doing things?
I think that's part of it. Although I'll tell you that one of the secrets to his success was he knew he had to climb Everest because that was something that was a milestone and it wasn't that common. And the other thing he knew was that he had to learn English. Because most of these treks, most of these people who were coming over to climb were Westerners who spoke English. And so he arranged to get English lessons from a woman named Miss Rita, who was a missionary. I think she was from Australia. And he used to say that was part of it, that he knew that he had to learn English. So it probably wouldn't be fair to say that he was hyperactive and wasn't interested in studying. I just think that he was very driven to a particular goal, and that if the learning went along that line, he was a very, very smart man. He could figure out how to make a barbecue grill and, you know, whatever. But he was also really driven.
And did those English skills help get him on that first expedition to Everest?
They absolutely did. He actually climbed in 1954. He met two Americans, a man named Will Seary, who was a scientist, and a climber named Willie Unsold. And they climbed Makalu together. They did not summit. They had bad weather. But he said his English skills improved dramatically. And then many, many years later, whenever he found out about the American expedition, it was primarily through those two men that the word got to the organizer of the expedition, which resulted in him being hired.
So, on that first team to summit Everest, he was 17 at the time?
In 53,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was his role there?
He was a high-altitude porter. So he was carrying loads of 65 pounds, largely oxygen tanks. And there's kind of a funny story about that. You know, this was a British expedition, and the man who was in charge of it was a guy named Lord Hunt. So it was all very, you know, proper. And Gambo was 17, and he was just kind of outspoken and, you might say, irreverent. And he noticed that he was carrying two oxygen tanks, 65 pounds, and Lord Hunt was only carrying one. So one day he takes him aside and he says, "You know, tell me about this. How come I'm carrying two and you're only carrying one?" And you know, everybody on the expedition is going, "Ah." But Lord Hunt just laughed at it and told Tenzing what his nephew said. And it was kind of like, "Oh, I'm going to box your ears," sort of thing.
Let's talk about the relationship between Tenzing Norgay, who was the person that went up with Edmund Hillary,
right,
on that very first people to summit Everest. Tenzing Norgay was his uncle. Were they close?
Yes, they were very close. And I think it would be fair to say that Gambo really worshipped his uncle. He wanted so much to follow in his footsteps and to be like him. It's ironic because Tenzing hired him for the 53 expedition. Tenzing did some amazing acts of charity towards Gambo through his life. But he was also the only person who really disappointed him. When Gambo was about to be hired to go on the 63 expedition, he was working at the Himalayan Mountaineering Institute, and his uncle was in charge of it. And he asked his uncle to write a letter that he might be able to use to get back pay when he returned from this expedition, because he was going to be gone for about 3 months. At the time, he had two children and one on the way. And so he was really afraid that he wasn't going to be able to provide for them. And his uncle told him, no, that because he was a government officer, that he wasn't able to do that. And his children tell me that that was a turning point in Gambo's life, that from then on, anybody who ever wanted anything, he would provide a letter of recommendation to get your child into a good school, to help you find a job, In later life, he helped raise money for families of Sherpas who died on the mountain. And he really was so aware of what it was like to be rejected that he pledged that he was never going to see that happen to other people.
And so his uncle just said no because he was a government official?
Well,
or?
There's probably more backstory to that. We don't know if that was the real reason that he said no. I've talked to his son, Norbu, about it. And it was one of those things that was kind of divisive in the family for a while. But I think it's also possible that Tenzing may have had his own pride and thought, you know, this kid is going to best me. He's going to climb it twice. But the excuse that he gave was that it was because he was a government officer, and it would appear that he was giving special privilege to his nephew.
You don't want competition, I guess.
I guess not.
What was Gombu's role in the kind of mountaineering community there in, you know, around Everest in that area?
Yeah. Well, he was highly respected. Once he went to work for the Himalayan Mountaineering Institute, it's a functioning facility in Darjeeling, India today, and it trains adult climbers. And he really played a huge role in that. One of the wonderful things that happened to him after 63 was because of his relationship with these Americans, he was invited to work at Mount Rainier in Washington State in the summertime. And he learned all kinds of climbing techniques there that really changed the way people in Asia were climbing mountains. It made them safer. They were more aware of what kind of equipment you needed in order to successfully summit. But primarily, it put people who were in India on even footing with people who were being trained in Switzerland and the United States and all over the world, because the best stuff at that time was coming out of the United States.
So he really brought back that knowledge. And
absolutely.
How did Gombu describe being at the top of Everest? Something, you know, the highest point on Earth, something that so few people really to this day have done.
You know, this is the classic reporter dream, isn't it? Is that you hear all of these eloquent things that people have written and said about what it was like to stand on top of the world. And let me tell you, Maria, those words all come to them after they're down. Because once you're up there, you're just so desperate. I mean, I'm sure, and I know from talking to many people who've summited, that there is this moment of awe, and that, you know, 2/3 of the Earth's atmosphere is below Everest. So things do look different. It almost looks like outer space when you're up there. But in Gombu's case, he was asked that at a press conference, and he said, "How to get down?" That's what I thought of whenever I got up there on top, because, you know, the clock is ticking the entire time you're at altitude. There's something that's called the death zone that is roughly anything above 20,000 feet. So that people who are summiting really are mindful of that, that you suffer consequences to your body that shut down, upsets your rational ability to gauge risk and danger. Some people suffer tunnel vision whenever they stay up there too long. And then, of course, frostbite's the most common thing that happens.
Well, I think probably the layman thinks about getting up there. You know, yeah. The experienced person knows that's only halfway.
Right. And they basically tell you that you have to reserve about 2/3 of your strength for the trip down, because you have the adrenaline push when you're going to the top. And it's a goal and you're excited and all that. And then when you come down, you think, wow, okay, that's cool. Let's go get a beer or whatever. And that it really the more challenging part is going down.
Wow. Well, in 1965, Gombu summited Everest for the second time with an Indian team. Was it different the second time around, or what was that experience like?
I think it was. The people who were with him talk about the fact that when they got there, that the ropes that had been set by the Americans were still there, which is really unusual. But that kind of reaffirmed the route that they had taken, that they were on the right track. He knew to tell them, you know, here's the part that's going to be the most difficult for you. Here's where we have to be at this time of day in order to be safe from the weather. But he was kind of reluctant to do it. And when they invited him, he basically said, well, why should I want to climb it again? And they said, well, how about if we give you a free plot of land and a scholarship for your kids? And he goes, deal, I can do that. Yeah.
So it worked out pretty well for him financially.
Absolutely.
That second time.
Absolutely.
Well, He seems like such a generous guy. You mentioned after the incident kind of with his uncle, like mm-hmm. it really changed his perspective. And he really gave a lot back, it sounds like, to the Sherpas around him and their families.
Yeah, and that was really the key to him. He was one of the most humble people I've ever met. Interviewing him was really a challenge because he, you know, you'd say, well, what about this? What about that? And he'd go, oh, yeah, you know, I climbed that. Oh, yeah, I climbed that. You know, and he was just so low-key about the whole thing. But he realized that he could make a difference in people's lives, and he, more than anything else, wanted to make sure his children got a good education, that education was going to be their Everest, that they were going to succeed in life because they had reached a level of education that would prohibit them from nothing. And he succeeded. His kids are all very, very accomplished. They have great jobs and wonderful lives. But I think that he was constantly driven by the fact that he started out poor and that he realized that his fame would change that for other people.
Are any of his family or children working in the you know, mountaineering in the Himalayas?
Yeah, yeah. He has a daughter who runs a trekking company, Yangdu, and it's called Remo Expeditions. He has four kids. Rita, who worked for Air India for a very long time and had a quite prestigious job. Yangdu. Finjo is a journalist in Toronto, and his youngest daughter, Angmu, is the head of human resources for, I'm going to blank on it, Bayer Industries in India.
Yeah. Well, we have another clip that we can play. In 1963, he also met President Kennedy.
That's right.
So let's hear a little bit of that.
We're very pleased that you brought with you as your guest those who went with you. I think it's very appropriate they should be here because they're very much a part of this great international effort.
President Kennedy and Gom and I were standing there and we were chatting about the Sherpa, and he said, I hear they're very strong. And I said, oh, Mr. President, feel his thigh. And so when Gom was standing there, the president grabbed Gom as the guy, and Gom said, if he's resurrected in the next life as a worm, he'll still remember the President of the United States grabbing him by the thigh. It was just amazing.
Yeah, it was a remarkable thing that he got to meet the president. There was also an incident that preceded that. One of the ceremonial offerings that people in the Sherpa culture give friends is a thing called a kata, and it's a white silky scarf. And he says that when he went to put that over the president's neck, that all of a sudden the security is all like, okay, what's he doing? What's he doing?
Oh, a gesture of goodwill,
yeah.
Not always interpreted quite as such by the security guards.
Right.
The president, I guess, felt his thigh and probably rock hard there. Did these Sherpas, I mean, did they do anything special to prepare, or was this just something that they'd been trained for by their own lifestyle?
Exactly. And I mean, there's some evidence that physiologically that they're different. Most of them were born at altitude, so they grew up, their body's processing less oxygen. There is some indication that as a result of this over the generations that they're able to process thoughts more readily at high altitude, which is certainly critical whenever you're joining an expedition. But they had just really hard lifestyles, so much manual labor, they walked everywhere, that over time they were bound to be strong and fit, and certainly when compared to the average American, they are strong and fit.
Well, you know, you've worked for years in television news here in Kansas City. How is doing a documentary different from that kind of daily turnaround of being a reporter?
You know, it really was a wonderful experience to have the luxury of saying, you know, I have more than an hour to become an expert on this subject. I can spend a couple of months. I can do research. It really was an incredible gift. There are benefits to doing the quick turn, and there's also the wonderful variety of coming in and not knowing what you're going to do that day. But at this stage in my career, this was just the perfect thing for me to do.
And, this takes place very far from your home. How did you go about researching and doing all these interviews and getting the footage for it all?
Yeah. Well, the fact-checking internationally is a fun thing to try. You really rely on the internet a lot. We did not have a sponsor for this. And so when we approached people about getting access to video, et cetera, they'd say, oh, yeah, what do you need? And then we'd say, well, first of all, you need to know we have no budget. Mm-hmm. And so that was, it was kind of interesting because in some ways that really opened doors for us because people realized that we were doing this as a gift rather than something to try and make money. We called it the frequent flyer documentary. We used frequent flyer mileage to get to India and to Switzerland. Gambu's family put us up when we were over there, so that saved us a great deal of money. But one of the things is that when you told people that you were doing this about Nawa and Gambu, if they knew him, if they had any connection whatsoever, they said, oh, we'd love to help. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We'll do this.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you did the last interview with Gambu. What was that like?
Well, it was weird. I didn't know him. He had a very strong accent. He was hard, as you and I were talking about other people we've interviewed over our careers. He was hard to get anything out of. And when it was over, I talked to my girlfriend and I said, Maylee, I don't think we got anything. She says, are you kidding? That's the best one he's ever done. I've interviewed him. And I said, oh, okay. All right, never mind. But he was just this sweet guy. If he was here today, he'd be making sure your seat was comfortable. He'd be asking if he could get you a cup of tea. He was a helper. And that was really the role that he performed, whether you were trying to interview him or whether you were on a trek.
Well, you've been to Nepal, India, Switzerland on this project. What's next for you, Bev?
Well, I haven't been to Nepal. That's the one that
sorry.
I still haven't been to. No, that's okay. It's still on my list.
You can still go there. Maybe that's next.
Thanks. Well, I think I'm a believer in what fate throws at you. And this summer I found myself surrounded by the West Fork Fire Complex in Southwest Colorado. And it was a really humbling experience. And I had access to a lot of people who were affected by the fire. I work in a small town out there in the summertime that was really struggling because of the publicity about the fire. At the same time our fire was going on, the tragedy in Yarnell happened, and it was really fascinating to see how that changed just the whole atmosphere of what was going on in Colorado. So I think that's probably where I'm headed. I also do commercial video production in Kansas City to make some money. But I think that probably my next documentary will be something about forest fires.
I guess it can't all be low-budget documentaries.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and look forward to hearing about your next project, too.
Thanks.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll shift our attention to Karl Marx and everything from how he became a radical to his life as a family man. Central Standard returns in just a moment.